Hello and welcome once again to the Oklahoma Atheist Godcast, digital audio stream in which the members of the AOK are casting gods out, broadcasting our doubt, and casting about for answers to difficult questions. Today on the show is part two of our interview with John Loftus. He is the founder of the Debunking Christianity blog and the author of Why I Became an Atheist and editor of The Christian Delusion. We'll put all those links on the blog at blog.oklahomaatheists.com. Enjoy the show.
So suppose we convince someone to go ahead and take the outsider test. You say, you know, just for the sake of some sort of epistemic consistency, you really should try to look at everything from the same outside view with a sort of default agnostic position going into any evaluating any faith. How should they best go about that?
Oh, well, I've suggested some ways. Of course, you know, reading the literature, I have something on my blog called the Debunking Christianity Challenge. On my blog, by the way, it's debunkingchristianity.blogspot.com. And there's a few books I've recommended. Of course, you know, what author would not recommend his own?
Right.
So I do. There's some things, you know, read some things. I mean, there would be opportunities to visit free-thinking groups to talk with them. But apart from that kind of thing, you know, I recommend starting from the beginning when you first came to believe. How did you come to believe? You know, what was it that convinced you? How much did you know at the time? Did you ever meet a skeptical person? When you first decided to choose to believe, had you researched it, or did you just hear whatever someone told you? I mean, and then contrast that with a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon missionary who would come to your doors. And what if that missionary had approached you at the same time in your life when you were like searching for significance, or you were lonely, or you were in need of something, you know? And would you have embraced Mormonism at the time, you know? And ask those kinds of questions about your initial faith. I mean, let's say a person researches into buying things quite heavily. You know, he goes to buy a new car. He subscribes to Consumer Reports, you know, and he kicks the tires, you know, a few cars, drives them around, choose which car he wants. Well, that's what you would want to do. Then you'd have to step back and say, well, let's just start all over and let's kick a few tires here and let's just examine, let's just put them all on the equal playing field and see if any of them emerges as a better contender. So, you know, that kind of thing. And that means reading skeptical books. That means reading Mormon books and Jehovah's Witness books and Mormons and Hindus. I mean, if you really want to make a serious choice in the matter, you need to examine more than the first person who comes at your door, knocks at your door and says, "Hi, Allah loves you."
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
The most benevolent, the most merciful Allah. They start almost every surah with most. I'm about to go off on a tangent here.
Yeah.
Not going to do it. It's just that they always threaten hell within a few verses of that.
Oh yeah,
the most merciful. Like three verses later, hell, fire, and boiling water.
They can scare you. I mean, that's the best way. I mean, people, you know, indirectly kind of start thinking along the lines of Pascal's wager in that sense. Like, you know, it's like, well, if I don't believe this, I'm going to go to hell. So, I mean,
so I'm going to choose the religion with the nastiest hell, just, you know, for the sake of the wager.
I've seen so many people who would write me and say, you know, I'm really afraid that I might get this wrong, and, you know, because of hell. And, you know, I simply say to them sometimes, you know, I say, well, are you afraid of Allah's hell? See, the Shiites think the Sunnis are going to hell and vice versa. And, you know, there's some strict Catholics who think the Protestants are going to hell and vice versa.
Yeah,
and then there are Protestant snake handlers. And then, of course, there is the Westboro Baptist Church who thinks homosexuals and anybody.
Everyone's going to hell except for them. Yeah.
Nobody is really afraid of anybody else's hell. They're only worried about the one they were raised in to believe and to be scared of.
So one of the best practical ways to take the outsider test would be to read your books, to read Michael Martin, Nicholas Everett, Hector Avalos, Paul Tobin, Bart Ehrman, those sorts of books to get a sense of why there are reasons to doubt your own faith, and those are mostly directed at Christianity, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's more. I mean, Bob Price and Richard Carrier stuff. I mean, you know, I don't want to miss, you know, I don't want to leave anyone out. You know, someone asked me for 10 books, but yeah, that kind of stuff. You know, like it's like going around kicking cars before you decide which car to buy. I mean, why didn't you do that initially? You know, do it now. Become that adult. Become that questioner. You believe whatever your parents told you, and so now you're an adult. It's time for you to check it out for yourself, and to do that, you know, that's how you do it. You have to start with researching as if you hadn't made a choice to begin with, because if you don't attempt that anyway, then you've got the thumbs of faith on the weighing scales, which is the unfair way of how to treat religious faith.
We'll link to the Debunking Christianity Challenge on the blog when we post this episode. Why is it Christianity in particular is the focus of your attention? Is it because it's what you came from and what you've seen actually change people's lives for the worse, or is it a cultural thing? Or?
Well, I'm not one that says that religion poisons everything. I'm not one like that. If religion is created by human beings, okay, then it's going to have some good things in it, just like any philosophical tome does, or any social tome. Anyone who writes anything is going to have some good ideas, and it's going to, you know, change their society, the world, depending on how you know, good their argument is and how influential they are. So since religion texts are written by human beings, you're going to find some good things in there, but you're also going to find a lot of bad things, you see, and I don't like the bad things, so I speak out against them, and there's a lot of them. I mean, I think we ought to get rid of that kind of religion in our society. I think fundamentalist or evangelical Christianity is an aberration. I mean, I just think that deadens the critical thinking skills. I think it causes you to vote for Sarah Palin, support, you know, people that should never be in office in the first place. See, actually, my motivations are feminist in orientation, gay in orientation, and liberal in orientation. I want to change the political structure of Western society as much as I personally can, meager as those efforts are. Because I think we'd be better off as society without that religious influence. And, I don't say much about how feminism motivates me because of how religion treats women. Mm-hmm. But it motivates me quite a bit. And you see some gay bashing on TV, you know, from bullies right now going on. I mean, it just seems like to me that stuff's got to go. And we got to get rid of those people who have their... Well, I say get rid of them. Listen, I'm not a militant. Nobody's going to die. I mean, argue them out of power. You know, I mean, vote them out of power. This is a democracy. I fully support the church. You know, separation of church and state. Fully support it. But yeah, these things are. Christianity is what I know. Evangelicalism is what I know. And my goal is to push evangelicals off dead center, so they're no longer quoting the Bible in answer to any question, and they are forced to think for themselves. That's my goal. It's a dirty work. Sometimes it's the maddening work. It's the work that gets me all kinds of accusations about this, that, and the other, and nobody likes that. They'll do that to me because I'm trying to debunk their faith. It's the dirty work. It's easy work, but it's also the hardest work. Easy because it's easy to do, but hard because of how they treat you. In order to change society, you know, for the better. And so, it's the only thing I know. I mean, it's the thing I know best.
If the evangelical Christians in a generation or two are much more like the liberal Episcopals now, and they're, you know, they're gay-friendly, they feel like women should have equal rights, and you know, if they're more feminist and just generally accepting of people who are marginalized minorities now...
Mm-hmm.
Will you feel like your work is done, or will you still feel the need to debunk the mythology just because it's there?
Well, let's picture that world. Let's picture that world of Episcopals, just exactly as you said, very liberal, willing to ordain gay bishops and what have you. Is my work done? Well, I certainly would not be passionate about what I'm doing. You know, I'll tell you that. I think that to the degree people can sign the Humanist Manifesto 1 and the Humanist Manifesto 2 and the what's called the Humanist Manifesto, which has been put out in the last few years, I think, maybe the last, well, anyway, last couple, last year or two, I think to the degree you can sign those manifestos, even as a religionist, then I find myself, embracing you. I mean, it seems like to me, yes, I'm an atheist. Yes, I don't think there's a God, you know. But the thing that I'm passionate about is the fundamentalist kind of Christianity, the evangelical kind. And, I'll be very happy living in a society with all Episcopals of the variety of the liberals, you know. I mean, not exactly totally satisfied, of course.
Mm-hmm. So it's really the moral consequences of the literalist thinking that gets to you.
It really is. I mean, it's a majority of that. I mean, I don't like anyone punting to faith. You know, I think you got to have your critical thinking faculties about you at all times, except when you're drinking a good beer.
Amen.
That's okay.
Yeah.
But, I just think that the consequences, although you heard me say earlier, I don't think that following religion, religious teachings are always bad for you. I mean, I've seen marriages heal because of a religious influence. It might be for the wrong reasons, but they're back together, you know. I mean, I've also seen marriages split up because of religious reasons, too. So, what's the net gain? I don't know. But, I just want people to think for themselves and not punt to faith and not to, you know, that God's going to solve this problem and I don't have to worry about it. No, you got to solve it, you know.
You know, so. At the very least, I know you talked about earlier about how people, you know, like in the pool halls and stuff will hear that you're an atheist and just think, wow, how can you believe that? At the very least, you know, even if everybody becomes these tolerant Episcopalian or like United Church for Christ, the very least that these that works like this can do is to show that atheists have a rational reason for being atheist. So people don't necessarily just think, oh, this person's just an atheist because they're mad at God or something. So,
right.
You know, at the very least, it makes people understanding that, you know, atheist, you know, is a legitimate state or a legitimate rejection of beliefs.
Yeah, like Dan Barker, I was really content in my faith. I didn't feel the need to go anywhere. It's just turned out that when I looked into it and took something more like the outsider test approach, I found that I couldn't support it. I was trying to be an apologist and losing every significant battle I got involved with. After a while, you realize it's not just you. It's that you just don't have the ammunition.
Yeah.
I'm editing a new book called The End of Christianity, and I've got a section in one of my chapters where I say, you know, defending the faith makes otherwise brilliant people look dumb.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does take those brilliant people to come up with these answers, I'll tell you that. Smarter than me, I'll tell you that. It's because they still believe. No, I don't mean to say that. I mean to say that it takes mental contortionism of a gigantian terms that I don't think that you need to gerrymander the data that much, but that's what they have to do to defend their faith.
Speaking of the books, let's go ahead and plug your books for the people that don't know yet. There's still plenty of people out there that haven't heard. Your first one was Why I Became an Atheist. Tell us that. That's more of a personal journey, the kind of arguments that convinced you.
Yeah, I consider that my magnum opus. That contains, I think I put everything into that, and I even hope to revise it in a year or two to make it even bigger. I mean, people have described it as a sort of encyclopedic in the scope, because it's not, by the way, it's an encyclopedia. It's just 428 pages, but I packed a lot into it. Covers my personal journey, and then I separated it into basically two large sections. The first section is the basis for your control beliefs and why being skeptical is healthy and a better way to approach the evidence. And then the second half of the book is looking at the evidence from the Bible itself, and the evidence for, say, the incarnation or the atonement or the resurrection, you know. And then, of course, then I've got a small final section on what it means to be an atheist and what finally tipped me over, you know, into the atheist camp, and, you know, what's it like to live like an atheist and something like that. So it's really a complete case from start to finish. I mean, it really is. And it's not necessarily a pretty story about my life, but, you know, hell, no, that's just who I am. I didn't try to make it pretty.
Oh, yeah, I was looking at the next book, The Christian Illusion. I've actually got both your books sitting here in front of me, but or your both your books that are published right now, obviously, because I know you also have a third book, but that's due out sometime in 2011. But for The Christian Delusion, I noticed in the introduction, you kind of, you know, sort of separated it out from your first book, Why I Became an Atheist. Could you explain how that book is really different from your first book?
Yeah, you know, it doesn't have, you know, I mean, it's not about my personal story any longer. I decided to try to find some experts on certain issues that could write more more of a detailed way about the sorts of things I wrote in my Why I Became an Atheist. You know, I wanted them to help me argue for my case. You know, nobody can know everything. I don't. And so I was able to enlist some people who can make my case for me. You know, Bob Price, Rich Carrier, Dr. Avalos, David Eller, you know, Ed Babitsky has a great chapter, Paul Tobin, I like his book, I Had to Ask Him, Valerie Chirico. Yeah, it's an edited anthology, but it's geared around a theme. You know, its main focus is about the outsider test for faith, although, you know, it covers all kinds of different issues. It's great, but people like it.
I found it was very comprehensive, and you picked really good authors on each topic. And I thought that was it's a fantastic compilation. So the best one I've seen in a while. And it has a lot of the modern philosophy in it, which is great.
And I noticed it doesn't like your first book, it kind of seemed like you were sort of arguing against the existence of the Christian God and such, and why you rejected the Christian God. The second one kind of seems more to not deal with necessarily arguing against the Christian God. It kind of seems like it goes more towards different subjects, like various Christian delusions, such as, you know, the idea
right.
that Christianity created science, or the idea that, you know,
right.
the idea that the Bible gives evidence of the resurrection, things like that, things that don't really necessarily, you know, disprove Christianity, but disprove various myths about Christianity.
Right.
Yeah, I did. That's right. Especially Hector Avalos' chapter on Hitler and Carrier's chapter on science. You know, yeah, just various delusions. Now, specifically geared towards undermining Christianity. I mean, people would say, "Well, what if Hitler was a Christian? So how does that disprove Christianity?" Well, see, they could say that if they wanted, but you know, I'm just basically tired of Christians saying, "Well, Hitler was a." Was an atheist, you know. Well, here's one of the delusions. See, if you have a delusionary faith-based way of thinking, then you're going to interpret evidence in a skewed way. Well, Hector Avalos masterfully takes us through that evidence and shows us that Hitler was definitely a Christian. It was a different kind of Christianity, but, you know, people who are Christians will say, well, that's not my type of Christianity, so he wasn't a Christian. Well, you know what? You could say that about any different denomination.
No true Scotsman fallacy.
Exactly.
Whatever Hitler believed, like, the actual genocide was carried out by Christians, like, throughout the whole society.
That's the bottom line.
It was a Christian nation,
it was a Christian society.
By all means.
They were either Protestant or Catholic, and neither church was really doing anything to condemn what was going on.
Exactly. It really doesn't matter then, you know, what Hitler was or wasn't. I mean, you had Lutherans and Catholics killing people, massive amounts of people, and you know, Jews, Polish people. I mean, so you know, even if Hitler was not a Christian, why did the Christians in Germany kill so many people? You know, you say, well, they obeyed orders. Don't just give me a break on that one. They wore God with us belts and. You know, they got lots of pictures of them attending Christian weddings and Christian funerals and on and on.
And there's hardly an army I can think of that doesn't at some point have something akin to the Gott mit uns belt buckle. We've had scandals in our military recently where they're putting scripture verses on rifle sights and shooting Qurans.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and the
right.
serial numbers they put various numbers for scripture verses on the serial numbers.
And you know the chaplains they do. I mean, you were in the Marines.
Eric was. Although my experience with chaplains is I guess I got lucky with chaplains.
I think
didn't get a lot of the crazy crazy religious ones that I hear about so much, but
Anyway, I have one last question for you, and Eric, if you have any, you can shoot. But we always ask contemporary atheist authors this question: are you being a dick?
Why? Because of Phil Plait? Is this guy?
Do you have any comments on the controversy over whether or how aggressive we should be with our message?
Sometimes I am, and sometimes I'm not. It depends on who I'm dicking. But if I want to have a persuasive conversation with a Christian, then I can't be a dick. I mean, I have to treat their faith respectfully, and I have to treat them respectfully as a person as well. If I'm, however, dealing with someone that is, it's obvious, is not interested in the truth, I've met them also, you know, I mean, I just blast them away, you know, I mean, they've basically removed themselves from a polite civil conversation, and, you know, they're not interested in an honest dialogue, and, I'll blast them, sure I will.
So dick unto others as they have dicked unto you?
A golden rule of dicking.
Well, I guess it's more like I'm not going to waste my time with you. But, you know, sometimes ridicule is a means of changing someone's mind, like it's persuading somebody. If you walked into a room or if you lived with people and all they said was, that's ridiculous, that's stupid, I can't believe you would accept that. You know, the mind is such a device that it will begin questioning itself. We're all mm-hmm. self-doubters, and so there is room for some ridicule, and the people who will never change and who are online to argue you out of existence, you know, that they won't change. So sometimes if you turn to ridicule in front of the people who are reading, who are honest, and who are interested in honest discussion, that does and can have its effect. So mm-hmm. it depends on who I'm dealing with, I guess.
Yeah, I believe that. I remember the first people I ever ran to, it was predictably enough in college, who ridiculed faith, and they're like, really, you believe that? Did you read what it said here in the Bible? I'm like, oh, God, really? So, yeah, it was effective. It got me to think about it. Eric, you had one last question?
Yes. Well, I mean, the point of this podcast was mainly dealing with the outsider test for faith, and I notice when the outsider test for faith is, whenever you describe it, it kind of sounds to me sort of like, it sounds to me kind of like a common sense thing, but I've noticed that, I mean, you've dedicated a chapter to it in Why I Became an Atheist, you dedicate an entire section to it in The Christian Delusion, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought you had said something about during the Texas Freethought Convention about potentially coming out with a whole book dedicated to it, and my question is, I mean, if it's so common sense, why have so much literature over it?
Well, I guess you could make the case that because I'm not clear about what it is. I mean, you could try to make that case. I just don't think that case can be made. Although that's one way to escape any argument is simply try to find ways to say, you know, I don't even know what you're talking about. And I still have people who say, well, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, what clearer way of describing it but say you should treat all religious faiths equally, with an equal amount of skepticism, where there are no double standards, you know, favoring one over the other. I mean, how much more clearer can you be? Well, so they'll say that. I don't think the case can be made. It just seems like to me that given the impact of that simple test and the sociological and anthropological and psychological data that forms the backdrop for it, that they intuitively know that this test will destroy their faith. And so, I mean, they have to buck it. So they have to find reasons why, you know, it's not a good test, even though it seems so self-evidently obvious. You know, it's like someone walking into court, raising his hand and say, Your Honor, I really want you to make an unfair judgment today based on partiality towards my case, or, you know, based on partiality towards my opponent's case, because that's exactly what they find themselves doing, but they can't come out and say it that plainly, so they have to come up with all kinds of subterfuge. But yeah, so it seems like to me, that's one of the reasons why I have to write a book about it. I mean, you know, the arguments just keep coming, and that means I've hit a nerve.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good talking to you.
Oh, okay, thanks so much.
Bye.
This podcast is a production of the Oklahoma Atheist, an organization dedicated to developing a community of like-minded individuals who share the ideas of free and critical thinking, and as opposed to the uncritical acceptance of faith-based ideas and norms. Our activities include dinner meetups, potlucks, family outings, debates, speeches, book clubs, volunteer opportunities, and political events and protests. We welcome all who share the ideals of critical thinking and who reject religious dogma. In addition to cultivating a community, we wish to contribute and put a face with all positive things non-believers and people with a secular viewpoint are doing in the world. If you'd like to know more, please visit us online at www.oklahomaatheist.com.